This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for listening to the Evening Edition. So here's the thing about Woody Allen. There is no middle ground. The man and his art do not inspire indifference in any way. You either love his movies or hate his movies. It's really that simple. But like him or loathe him, one can't help but be curious about what makes him tick. About his philosophy behind the comedy. I know I'm curious about all those things, which is why I'm thankful for Finding the Funny, where Ezra speaks to Mark T. Conard, an associate professor of philosophy at Marymount Manhattan College in New York, all in an attempt at addressing my curiosities about Woody Allen. Go listen to the show. It's good, it's comedic, it's cinematic, it's all philosophical-like. Just log on to bfm.my and search for Woody Allen.
Hey everyone, now before we start tonight's show, I need you to bear with me on this following sequence. So, say you're waiting in line at a bank, and it's broad daylight, possibly during lunchtime, and it's kind of busy. And it should be a quick transaction, the only problem is there are five people ahead of you. People are getting impatient. And then you hear something behind you. There's some sort of commotion at the front entrance.
Excuse me, sir?
You turn around, and here's where you manage to pick out every little detail. They're all wearing masks. One of them is taller than the rest. The aggressive one, he seems to be taking charge. And before you know it, he's pulled out a gun.
Everybody get down on the floor now!
Get down on the ground!
You have 4 seconds. Anyone still standing gets shot. One, two...
Put your hands on the floor, now!
There's panic, and you sense the fear. You'll do anything to avoid getting hurt. And you'll listen to everything they say. They have your undivided attention.
My friends and I are making a very large withdrawal from this bank. Anybody gets in our way, gets a bullet in the brain.
These guys, they've locked down and secured the entire space. They have guns, but more importantly, what they have here is leverage.
I have got hostages. You cops come near this door, I start killing people. I'm not kidding, man.
Central, give me an 85. Perp with a gun, possible hostages.
And what you need more so than anything else at this point is a hostage negotiator.
Are you the hostage negotiator?
That's right, Detective Frazier. This is Detective Mitchell. What do you got?
There's Denzel Washington. He comes through, and of course, Clive Owen. He's the villain with the English accent and everything. He then gives Denzel a list of demands.
One jumbo jet with full gas tank and pilots at JFK Park in the runway. We give you till 9 p.m. to do this, then we'll kill one hostage every hour. Till I talk to them, they get nothing.
And then the stalling begins. Tactical units, they get into their respective positions to secure the area so that they can get a clear shot. The negotiator, he picks up the phone and tells the bad guy,
just let everybody stay calm, okay?
Don't I sound calm to you?
Yes, you do.
This goes down wrong. They're gonna dump this whole mess in your lap.
You're listening to VoiceBox, the show that takes a look at the power and pervasiveness of the human voice in shaping our everyday world. I'm your host, Ezra Zayed. And throughout this series, we'll examine the impact of this uniquely human instrument and the role it plays in making and breaking the bonds between us. This week, we take a look at the role of a hostage negotiator. And the earlier sequence you just heard, that was fiction, of course. And it was taken from the film Inside Man. It was directed by Spike Lee, and the cast included the likes of Denzel Washington, Clive Owen, Jodie Foster. And very quickly, it paints a picture. Or maybe it reinforces certain ideas about what you think happens in a crisis or hostage negotiation. But is it accurate?
The biggest discrepancy that TVs and movies and sometimes novels typically project is that the negotiator is sort of out there all by him or herself, just tricking somebody with mental jousting and convincing somebody to do what they don't want to do. And that's just such an oversimplification.
The career and true life experiences of my guest this evening, it comfortably trumps anything that was written in any Hollywood screenplay. I mean, he's been involved in
hostage barricade suicide situations, prison riots, right-wing militia standoffs, hijackings, kidnappings.
And to tell us what really goes on behind every word and delivery of a hostage negotiator, I'll first let him introduce himself.
My name is Gary Nessner, and I'm the former chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit. I was in the FBI for 30 years and spent the last 23 as a negotiator and the last 10 as the chief negotiator for the FBI.
And he's also the author of a fascinating book called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. Here's more of my chat with him. And for the average guy on the street like myself, I mean, I have close to zero reference of figuring out exactly what a hostage negotiator does. And that reference usually comes from Hollywood, whether it's CSI or Law and Order when you think about TV shows, or whether it's Kevin Spacey and Sam Jackson in The Negotiator, Denzel Washington in Inside Man, that's all we've got. I mean, what's the percentage of what we see in Hollywood to be anywhere remotely true of what you used to do?
It's very small. In fact, almost all, I don't watch any law enforcement shows like Law and Order and CSI, because most of them are so separated from, factual experience that, it just frustrates you to watch them. And the same is true with negotiations. First and foremost, negotiations predominantly takes place in the context of a team. So on a particular incident, I might be the one talking on the phone to the gunman inside the bank, but I have three or four or five other colleagues with me who are helping me analyze the situation, assess the communications, and make recommendations on how I should approach dealing with this person. So we try to leverage the skills and abilities of a much larger team to our advantage. And I think that's the biggest misconception about it.
Gary, at which point during your tenure at the FBI, did you begin to start learning more about hostage negotiation? And when you did, I gather that at that point in time, it wasn't something that was well developed.
Yeah, I joined the FBI in 1972. And a few years after that, this new discipline emerged called hostage negotiations. And it was something the FBI really borrowed from the New York City Police Department that initially came up with the concepts, and it essentially provided a framework for resolving dangerous situations. Instead of the police going in with guns blazing, now they would contain an incident so that the risk wouldn't spread elsewhere, and then you open the dialogue with the perpetrators in order to try to get them to surrender peacefully. And that approach was fairly new and fairly rudimentary. Obviously, we learned a great deal more of the science behind the communications and the specific techniques that we could expand upon to make it more of a successful discipline. But yeah, so it was pretty early in. I would never say that I originated it by any stretch of the imagination, but I certainly got involved in it at a fairly early level.
And Gary, I guess I should have asked, what drew you to this particular discipline? I mean, what about it attracted you to get into this field?
Yeah, when I was doing some training in the FBI, I was had the opportunity to be exposed in a very superficial way to this new discipline. And immediately upon hearing about it, there's something that I found very attractive: to use communication skills and to use your wits and your personality to try to diffuse a situation. I think some of those skill sets were sort of natural in my personality. So I was attracted right away to become involved in that challenging new discipline, and the rest is history.
In your book, Stalling for Time, you actually speak a little bit about your perceptions of the FBI and what the public had of this particular institution, because it certainly left an impact on you growing up.
Well, yeah, I mean, particularly for your listeners, in KL, the FBI had enjoyed a very illustrious history in the United States, and A lot of that was glamorized back, in the 30s and 40s, and the FBI arresting gangsters and catching spies during World War II, and these days terrorism and so forth. So the FBI had sort of it was considered a very prestigious institution in the United States. So it's not surprising that as a young man, when I saw a television show about it on a children's show, that it sort of resonated with me, and it became the area of my future career's focus. And I was fortunate enough that, my dream actually came true, and I became an FBI agent. So something I've always been extraordinarily proud of.
And at the time, were people in your field analyzing the pros and cons of, say, swarming in, guns blazing, etc., versus establishing rapport and trust with the bad guys? I mean, anytime a new approach like this gets introduced, not everyone necessarily in your field welcomes it with open arms. Was there pushback to this approach?
Yeah, there was, and there still is. And you see it around the world with less sophisticated law enforcement agencies, but you also see it here within the United States and even some of the more industrialized countries. There's always a feeling in law enforcement that we in law enforcement have the authority of the government. And when we tell someone to do something, they need to comply. And when we are met with resistance, it often evokes frustration on our part and sometimes anger. Policemen and women are human beings, and they have their own pressure points and buttons that they get angry over. So there's always this undercurrent of quickly using force to make someone do what we want. And so it takes a more thoughtful approach and the realization that by taking our time and engaging in dialogue, not only is that a better outcome typically for the perpetrator, but it prevents us from putting officers in dangerous situations or from us inadvertently hurting, an innocent bystander or a hostage, whatever.
Don't go anywhere, because after this, we find out exactly how does one engage in a dialogue with someone who has put him or herself in a dangerous situation. My guest tonight, he's Gary Nesner, the former chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit. You're listening to VoiceBox. More after this on BFM 89.9.
Business, finance, and music. BFM 89.9.
I'm Ezra Zayed, and you're still tuned in to VoiceBox, the show that examines the impact of this uniquely human instrument and the role it plays in making and breaking the bonds between us. And we're taking a peek at the work of a crisis or hostage negotiator. In preparation for this show, I tried to do some homework, and arguably that involved watching The Negotiator, starring Samuel Jackson. Yeah, that's right, it's cult research. And it co-stars with Kevin Spacey. And I wanted to share with you a scene in the film, and he plays the chief negotiator, Chris Sabian. And what you need to know here is that having just arrived on the scene, he's not happy with the conduct of some officers on the tactical team. They're the one with the guns. And when not working in tandem between the negotiation team and the tactical team, this makes the entire process very problematic.
Is this your command or is it his?
Oh, and if you're listening with your kids right now, just bear in mind that there's some colorful language that has already been bleeped out.
You had him distracted. We saw an opportunity to end this. We had to take it.
No, you put me and those hostages at risk. That's what you did. And that's not how I work. First, we talk.
It was my call. We don't feel this man can be talked down.
Oh, really? I've been here a half hour. How do you know that? With all due respect, sir, I have kept a zero casualty rate for 5 years, precisely because this kind of action is a last resort.
This is not your command, Sabian.
Yeah, that's right. You know what my command is? To get those people out safely. That's my command!
Well, you don't know this man, Lieutenant! He's manipulating this whole situation. Look what he did to Palermo. He's gonna f*** with every single f*** one of you! If we give him enough time, and he knows you'll do it, because he knows how you f*** work.
He's got a point, Sabian. And we do have a chain of command here.
Yeah, your chain of command has just given Danny Roman two more hostages. Officers! You could take responsibility if he takes one of them out? Because I don't! They're just waiting to take this over. You want that to happen? So this is going to be very easy for you. Roman asked for me, and he's going to get me. We're going to do it my way, or I walk. I got no truck with leaving you with this responsibility. Now it's your decision, or they're going to f***ing take it over!
My guest tonight, Gary Nesner, he was in the FBI for 30 years, and he was also the chief of the FBI's crisis negotiation unit for a decade. And here's more of my chat with him. And so if we look at the structure and perhaps management of what happens during a crisis, there's a lot of things to consider. There's the negotiator, you, and there's the perpetrator, so that's one part of it, but there are innocent people involved. There are hostages. There are people in your team with different temperaments and different ambitions and objectives. There are just so many different circumstances to consider and manage all at the same time. Where do you begin in making sense of the process?
Well, there's a couple key concepts. First and foremost, what we've learned through the years is that by slowing down and containing the situation and opening up a constructive dialogue, we can resolve most situations peacefully in the 90 percentiles. Now, there are always going to be some people who are so violent, so mentally disturbed or influenced by drugs or suicidal that despite our best efforts, we don't get the outcomes we want. But the first thing we have to do is to surround the situation. So that requires, different police personnel to make sure it doesn't spread and endanger other people. Then once we've done that in a safe way, then we open up a dialogue and try to determine what the motivation is of the person. Are they holding a hostage because they're trying to get us to give them something? It's more likely, highly more likely, that we're facing someone that is upset over something that's happened to them in life, lost a relationship with a woman. They've had an argument with their boss. They've lost their jobs. There's almost always a sense of loss. And in those situations where the person is really motivated by high emotion, we're not really bargaining with them because they're really not trying to get anything of substance from us. So we have to provide them an opportunity to tell us from their point of view, how they've experienced this loss and what's bothering them and how they've not been understood or appreciated by others. And we, in that process, create a relationship of trust and hopefully soon get to a point where they will now listen to our suggestions when we give them alternatives to violence.
And sorry, and correct me if I'm wrong, with what you're describing, is this what they call the behavioral change stairway model? Is that what this is?
Yeah, pretty much. That's a model that I developed in the FBI, and I've modified it slightly. Probably from, I'm not sure the one you've seen, this is the one from my book, it's correct, but the goal is cooperation, and we're trying to get people to cooperate with us, to not harm themselves, not harm somebody else, to surrender peacefully so we don't have to hurt them or they don't have a chance to hurt us. These are the things that a responsible law enforcement agency will do. So in order to have that, to achieve that cooperation, we have to be able to have some influence over them. They have to be open to our suggestions and to our recommendations to how they can come out of this alive and it's the right thing to do. And in order to do that, we have to have a certain level of rapport and we have to be able to demonstrate that we're listening to them and understanding their point of view. We're not there to argue with them and tell them they're wrong about things. We're there to acknowledge their perspective. And, they expect police to be very authoritative and very argumentative and dictating. And instead they get a negotiator that says, wow, what happened today? And, sounds like you're really angry at your boss. And please, I'd like to know more about what happened. And for many of these people, it's the first time in their lives anybody's really listened to them. So it's a process. In other words, the stairway, the behavioral change stairway that I wrote is basically describing a process through which we eventually get to a level of cooperation, which is what we want.
And what you just mentioned there about listening, because trying to influence the other person on the other end of the line tends to be the obvious thing to do when trying to relate and understand someone else's problem. But in fact, listening carefully, which is terribly difficult to do, it's probably the key thing in creating that rapport. Is that right?
Yeah, most people do it backwards. And this is certainly highlighted in law enforcement and the military, but also with, say, males versus females. We tend to want to be very quick problem solvers. We'll see somebody making some bad decisions that are potentially self-destructive to them and to their lives, and we'll tell them what they need to do. So we'll show up and we'll say, hey, you know, if you kill your boss, you're not going to get your job back. So what you're doing is stupid and it doesn't make sense. Well, that's all very true, and it's accurate, but that's not the person not yet really ready to hear that from us. We have to earn, we have to demonstrate that we have earned the right to have a relationship with them, and we do that by listening. And we call listening active. If you just sit there and don't say anything, that's not really active listening. It's very passive. Active listening is by asking open-ended questions, by acknowledging his point of view. You know, I can see how that would frustrate you when you worked for this company so many years and yet you don't think they appreciated the contribution you made. I'm telling him through repeating in my words something he has told me, I'm telling him that I listen and I understand. And that's a powerful tool in any human interaction.
I have a question, and I'm trying to make sense of this a little bit. So on the one hand, you're trying to be frank and honest to the perpetrator so you can gain their trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's also another part of you that perhaps will say anything or even lie so that you guys have the best opportunity to kill the bad guy, and that gives you the desired outcome, if that is the best outcome. So, I mean, are there contradictions inherent to the job within that entire process?
I think a better way to put it, there are instances, and fortunately they're relatively few, where the negotiator actually has to think beyond a negotiation solution. There are those individuals we deal with who are so destructive in their behavior that now instead of working towards the total peaceful outcome, we're beginning to think about working them towards a situation that gives the police the advantage. Let's say they're in a bank and they have a bunch of hostages and they want to get a one car. Well, maybe it's to our advantage if they come out of the bank with fewer hostages. So they leave half the hostages behind, and we've just saved some of those hostages, and now it gives us a chance to get to this bank robber because now he's no longer in the bank, and he's easier for us to get to. Sometimes a negotiator has to do that. In the first chapter of my book, you know, certainly describes that kind of event. But the truth be told is those are very, very rare. And we always say that the outcome is ultimately decided by the behavior and the decisions of the perpetrator. You know, they and they alone decide whether they will ultimately cooperate and do what's in their best interest and something we want, that is to come out peacefully, or they will behave in a manner that leaves us with no choice but to take tactical action. So, you know, we can only influence events, and usually we're successful, but not 100% of the time.
That term, I don't know if you caught that, what he meant when he mentioned tactical action, I mean, it's an eerie thought. And so before we head to the break, here's a clip of comedian director Ricky Gervais elaborating on that point a little bit. Yeah, I know it's a bit of a leap, but I need you to trust me on this one. I think I just negotiated something with you, the listener. Anyway, so he's on the Graham Norton show, and here Gervais shares with us his conversation that he had with his bodyguard, who also acts as a hostage negotiator. Have a listen.
You have a bodyguard? You have your own bodyguard?
I'll tell you, I got a bodyguard in America, and I found out he was armed, so I was so excited. Like, boys never grow up. We go, you got a gun? He goes, yeah. I go, can I see it? It's a really quiet guy, and it's a suit, and we were just, you know, it's really down to earth, normal, just watching me and getting me in the car and everything. Then I found out he was special SWAT team in LAPD. Oh. So now I'm going, well, have you killed anybody? like a 10-year-old, right? And then he said, he dropped me off at the hotel. I said, I've got to go on a mission now, I've just been called. He went on to this a hostage situation. He is only one of the 9 negotiators. So when someone runs into a building and they take their kid, it's usually their child or their wife that they take hostage, not a stranger, and he has to talk them out. And I was fascinated. I was just boring him on the way to the airport. I asked him for like 2 hours, what'd you do then? And the first thing they do is They call the phone company and say, what's the phone number in that house? And they say, change one digit. So now only he can call this guy, because you can't have an engaged number when you're trying to... And
they learned that to the hard way, didn't they?
Exactly. And he tries to talk them out. And I said, what happens when if he says, look, I'm gonna kill everyone and you're not going to get me out? He says, then my only job is to get them to stand near a window. And I went, wow. And I said, then what? He says, you shoot them there, in a hostage situation, you shoot them in the top lip, because that takes out the brain stem, so there's no reflex, so they can't, they die instantly.
After this, we find out what are some of the tell signs or indicators during a negotiation process that suggests that the end might be near. More with my guest, Gary Nesner, former FBI chief negotiator. After the break, you're listening to VoiceBox, BFM 89.9.
So you're almost done with this podcast and you've got another 30 minutes or so to kill on the treadmill. What better way to while away the time than by listening to Ezra Zayed wax philosophical about the comedy of Woody Allen? Go listen to Finding the Funny. Just log on to bfm.my and search for Woody Allen.
Welcome back. I'm Ezra Zayed and this is VoiceBox, the show that takes a look at the power and pervasiveness of the human voice in shaping our everyday world. Tonight, we've been speaking about hostage and crisis negotiations. My guest, Gary Nesner, he's the author of Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And having been involved with them for about 30 years, his last 10 years there were spent as the former chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit. In going through this very difficult and trying process, is there a moment that you're looking out for as a sign or a particular thing that is said by the perpetrator that makes your ears perk up as a negotiator, that it seems like it's a tell?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is when you've been speaking to someone, and sometimes it doesn't take very long, and other times it could take hours and hours and days. But when you begin to hear the individual you're dealing with lower their emotion, cease using destructive words, you know, and angry words and swearing. And instead you begin to hear things like, you know, Gary, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get out of this. That is a sign to me that now this is almost a backward appeal. The person is telling me, help me find a way to get out of this problem. You know, so many of the individuals we deal with, and this is a mistake police officials make a lot, they feel as though the perpetrators have a very clear plan always set forth as to what they want to do and what they want to achieve. In most cases, that's not the case at all. People are acting on emotion and they have no idea how to get out of what they got into. So once you begin to hear some of those statements or questions from the perpetrator, now you can kind of rest assured that now you've created a little bit of a relationship and the person is actually looking for you to suggest to them things they could do. You know, here's what you might think about doing. You know, I know you're angry at your wife and you're angry at your boss. And because of that, you see one way of this resolving itself. Yet there may be other ways. You may be able to take legal action because you've lost your job unfairly. And maybe they don't think about those sorts of things. So there's a lot of different, I'm trying to answer your question as succinctly as I can, but it can be very complicated. But I think basically everything in life, particularly negotiations, is about creating relationships of trust. And whether you're selling cars or you're selling homes or you're whatever kind of businessman and you have to deal with your subordinates or in the media broadcast business, you have to create a relationship of trust so you can influence people.
One of the biggest hostage negotiations that he's ever been involved with, and in the book there's a huge chapter that's dedicated to this, it takes a look at the Waco siege, which took place in the United States in February of 1993. And it involved an isolated compound of a religious group living in Mount Carmel, Texas, which is near Waco. Here's CNN recapping the incident.
It is perhaps the most infamous raid in U.S. history. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms storms a large compound in search of illegal guns. It is home to a Christian cult called the Branch Davidians, an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
God speaks to me.
The leader is David Koresh, who describes himself as a sinful messiah. Authorities said Koresh was having sex with underage girls in his compound. He also had multiple wives and fathered at least 13 children. Koresh, who made money selling guns.
It's not against law to buy anything that they sell at a gun show.
Was not about to surrender peacefully when his home was raided, and along with his followers, took up arms against the authorities. 4 ATF agents were killed, at least 15 were wounded. 5 Branch Davidians were also killed in that initial raid, and Koresh himself took fire.
We'll see one of the holes here. Here's one of them.
The federal agents retreated. It was now a very tense standoff. FBI negotiators trying unsuccessfully to get Koresh and his followers to surrender.
Steve?
Yeah.
There's been a change. The tactical people have changed the situation, and for security reasons and for safety reasons, no one is now authorized to come out of there for any reason. And what they're telling me is that if anybody does, they are going to be dealt with in such a fashion that the people will have to retreat back to the compound.
What? I'm missing, I guess, what you're saying. Are you saying, make it as plain as possible.
The patience of the bosses is no longer where it was earlier.
Okay, about ready. Listen to me now, Henry. I don't really give a your bosses. When you tell me one thing or you tell us that is okay, and this Bradley comes up and says something contrary to what you are, you tell your bosses to get their butts together. Do you hear me?
On April 19, 1993, patience had finally run out. With specially modified tanks and grenade-like canisters, federal agents launched a tear gas attack to force the Davidians out. What happened next was a total disaster. Flames engulfed the compound, killing nearly everyone, including Koresh. 76 Branch Davidians dead, 24 of them children. Only 9 people made it out alive. Critics blame the FBI's tear gas for the blaze, but an independent special counsel ultimately found Koresh ordered the setting of the fires. And there were also some suicides and mercy killings inside the compound.
The Waco siege ended up lasting for 51 days, and it ended in disastrous circumstances. My guest, Gary Nesner, he reflects on this issue, and this is in 2010 with Houston PBS.
At Waco, of course, it's the longest chapter in my book. There were some fundamental philosophical disagreements within the FBI. I was there the first half, during which we secured the release of 35 people, including 21 children. And I think we were on track with a fairly good strategy. And there was a lot of external pressure on FBI leadership at the scene to tighten the pressure to resolve this sooner. It was very expensive and it made the FBI look powerless. And ultimately, they took a more confrontative approach that sadly broke off communications with the Davidians. And at the end, the FBI decided to insert tear gas to induce them to come out, and the Davidians started the fire that killed everyone inside.
What was the point, do you think, when it turned wrong? If you folks were on the right path, what was the tipping point?
Well, right near the end, right before I left, and I was sort of asked to leave because I was seen as an impediment to a more confrontational process. We got about 7 people out on one particular day, as I recall. And unfortunately, in response to that, the on-scene FBI commander took some very aggressive external action that, in essence, was the opposite of Pavlov. You know, when you reward good behavior, you don't punish it. And I told him at the time, when we train the dog to bring us the newspaper, we give it a bone. We don't kick it. And that's what we did. And that really, I think, finally capped it off for David Koresh. He said, if this is how you're going to respond to us, we're not going to let anybody else out.
Gary, what happens in a scenario where the person you're dealing with has, you know, some sort of extremist, fanatical, or religious justification to do harm and hurt innocent people? Does that change your approach?
Well, sure it does. I mean, you know, if in historically, in an overwhelming majority of cases, the people we're dealing with ultimately want to live more than they want to die, you know, and that's the pathway to success for us. However, if you know you run across a, you know, religious extremist, a jihadist, that you know, feels as though, you know, what they're doing is got religious sanctioning and they're willing to die for what they believe in, well, that makes it very, very difficult. It doesn't mean we don't try to negotiate, but what it means is the prognosis for success is much less.
And in those circumstances where it didn't work out, where the desired outcome was not achieved, what sort of toll or what impact does that leave on you as the principal negotiator? Does it leave a mark?
Well, it can, and that's one of the things we teach the negotiators is do not, you as an individual, take too much credit for success, nor should you take too much blame for failure. In other words, you know, we make a collective decision as a team of negotiators to do something, and you know, we're very unhappy when it doesn't achieve the ending we want. But we know from our experience that the outcome is eventually determined by the perpetrator. So you know, you just have to understand there's things you can change and things you can't, and you do the best you can, and that's part of being a professional.
In your book, you describe a variety of different scenarios in terms of hostage negotiations. If you could pick one, which one would it be that you felt was particularly interesting and unique?
Let me give you another example. Right after Waco, we had a prison riot in Ohio that I went and helped state authorities deal with. And there were inmates in this prison who had taken correctional officers as hostage. And there were different factions within the prison. So three groups of inmates had three different objectives and reasons as to why they wanted to hold on the hostages. And so the challenge became, how do we get these different prison groups to work together, to cooperate and come up with, a theme that we could then address? So we had to really organize them in our communications with them and explain to them, you know, you need to identify a representative. You need to put the list of ideas together that are things that are important to your group. Then we can sit down and we can discuss these. So we had to really take them by the hand, proverbially, and walk them through a process through which we enabled them to feel as though they accomplished some things out of this riot, but we accomplished our goal of getting all the correctional officers remaining released and restoring order to the prison and resolving the situation without further bloodshed. So, I mean, that's a good example of how we, you know, the authorities could have just simply charged in and overpowered the inmates, and there probably would have been some serious injuries, possibly some deaths. And yet this took a little longer, but it saved money, saved lives, and it helped create a better atmosphere in the prison after the riot.
We'll wrap up our conversation with Gary Nesner after this, and we find out if those negotiation skill sets are actually transferable to other areas in our lives. This is VoiceBox, BFM 89.9.
Bring forth Moolah, BFM 89.9.
Good evening, and tonight on VoiceBox, we've been looking at the many facets of hostage negotiation. I'm Ezra Zayed. One of the many strategies when dealing with a perpetrator is to make the hostage taker realize that his or her plan is unfeasible. So negotiators do this by peppering the hostage taker with questions. So if he wants a plane, ask where he wants to go. What kind of plane? And the negotiator always plays the role of an intermediary rather than the guy in charge. And that's partly a time-wasting strategy, because it gives cops, or the tactical unit, time to figure out the best way to make a tactical entry.
Listen, I can't work miracles over here. I'm going to need more time.
Well, perhaps if you'd use the time that I gave you more efficiently, you wouldn't be having this problem.
What do you want me to say?
That my plane is ready.
Okay, listen.
I promise you, God is my witness. I'm working on it as hard as I can. It's just going to take a few more hours. Why should I give you any more time?
Well, it's simple. You give me more time, you get what you want. You don't give me the time, you don't get what you want.
You got nothing to lose. Meanwhile, we'll send in some more food.
We've heard quite a bit thus far from my guest tonight, Gary Nesner, and he was a former chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit. So what happens when a demand is made, or several demands? What process does it go through when the perpetrator starts listing them out?
Well, there are different kinds of demands. You know, if somebody says, I want cigarettes, and I'll let one of these people go if you give me cigarettes, well, we're certainly going to find a way to make that deal happen. But if somebody wants something, give me $1 million or release, these 20 people from jail, or give me a plane so I can fly to wherever. I mean, these are things that you can't do. And so we typically on those will either stall, and we try to avoid telling them no right away. You'll never get that because we don't want them to overreact to that. But for example, somebody said, I want a getaway car. You know, my first response would be something like, well, it's very crowded out here. There's a lot of people outside this bank. There's a lot of confusion. And we're very concerned that if you got in the car and drove off, that, somebody would get in your way and there would be an altercation. Somebody else might get hurt. And, we have a responsibility, not for that to happen. And then you could say something like, we can't find anybody that wants to drive the car or anybody will give us a car. There's a lot of things you can say. But what you're eventually letting them know is that it's not going to happen. People that have hostages initially feel very powerful, that they can make the authorities do whatever they want. And that's the power of holding hostage. And then when time passes, hours and hours go by, and they can't get these things, it slowly convinces them that they are not as powerful as they thought they were. And they're left essentially with two choices. You either eventually comply with the authorities and surrender peacefully, or you stand a chance of getting seriously injured or killed. And fortunately, in most cases, they make the right choice.
I'm trying to think of a circumstance in which I guess it would make your job harder, but perhaps you can tell me and clarify. What if the perpetrator already knows what you're up to? What if they know your strategy and what sort of approach you're going to employ? Does that make your job harder?
Well, it doesn't happen too often, but it has happened, and it doesn't really make it difficult. Some people think it would be. But if you stop and think about it, let's say all of a sudden, somebody's saying, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to listen to me and hear my point of view. You say,
I'm just trying to think if, the perpetrator that you're encountering actually has read your book, and they say, look, Gary, I know what you're up to. you got to think of something else.
Well, I haven't heard that yet, but I would suggest to you, even if they had, that I believe it would work. Again, it's basically, if you read the sort of the philosophy that most negotiators around the world embrace, it's we're trying to listen and help this person acknowledge your point of view. So if somebody says, I know what you're doing, you say, yeah, of course, that's what we're doing. We want to see you come out of this alive. We don't want to have to use force. We don't want to see anybody else get hurt. We want to work with you to make this happen. So I don't think it hurts you one bit.
So the skill sets that you've learned in your years as a hostage negotiator, I imagine that it's really, that it's a useful tool in terms of how it would translate to, say, a negotiation in the boardroom. Is the psychology of it that terribly different?
Well, it's very similar. How we communicate with other people, how we get along with other people, that certainly has relevance in the boardroom as well as it would in a law enforcement situation. But there's some clear differences, too, in terms of the potential for violence. But I spend a lot of my time now teaching the corporations, speaking to corporations, rather, about the skill sets learned from law enforcement negotiations and their applicability in the business world. And, so there are some lessons to be learned.
In terms of initiatives and reforms that are taking place at law enforcement agencies, be it in the US or all around the world, or even the FBI, actually, when it comes to this issue of hostage negotiation, how much progress has been made with this particular discipline, or are we seeing some form of regress as well?
Well, I think there's been a great deal of progress. However, in I think the last 10 years, there's been some loss. There's been great progress in what we know, but there's been some degradation in practice because of terrorism and some of the issues you mentioned before. The concern is because of the Paris attacks and the Mumbai attacks and things like this, that now tactical response has again become more preeminent And I fear that that will mean less of an emphasis on the negotiation skills that I still believe in.
So is the discussion right now just that black and white, where it's a case of people saying that these negotiating strategies are no longer effective given this new type of threat, and therefore swarming in, guns blazing, effectively is the way to go? Is that?
No, I don't think people are. I mean, again, I think in some terrorism cases, there is a belief that the perpetrators are not susceptible to negotiations, and they're just going to kill their hostages. So the sooner we win and get them, the better. And, you know, it's a complex issue to discuss over a short interview like this, but I think there can tend to be an oversimplification and of that facet, and there can be an underappreciation of the role that negotiations play, even in those situations where we may end up using tactical force.
Gary, thanks for speaking to us. That was really insightful, and all the best to you.
You're welcome, Ezra. All the best.
My guest wrote the book Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. You can purchase it on Amazon.com. My sincere thanks to Gary Nesner. Hope you enjoyed this episode of VoiceBox. Head over to BFM.my for more podcasts from this series. I'm Ezra Zayed. Thanks for tuning in. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.